All right, let's go ahead and open up to John. We looked at John 2 last time. Maybe it'd be a good idea. We looked at the encounter with Mary, but I think it's a good idea. We went through this in a little more detail last week, so I'm not going to go through it again, but I think sometimes, so we don't get lost among the trees, it's always a good idea to kind of stop a second and remember what the forest looks like. So I kind of chopped off a segment here, the first five chapters of John, as kind of a part of the forest, anyhow, a large section of the forest, because John is a pretty big book, so we don't want to try and take it too big of pieces. And I just see, as you go through here now in John 1, and then if we were to go, we did this last week, so we won't do it again, but if you go to the end of chapter 5, there you have this whole segment. I see this as a unit. Sometimes people just break up this unit from Cana, with the wedding feast in Cana, the changing of the water to the wine in Cana. Then the end of chapter 4 ends with him returning to Cana and doing performing another sign there, the healing of the nobleman's son. And sometimes they look at that as the key unit, and that's certainly a unit. But I think this is even a broader unit. This encompasses that, I think it encompasses more. And when you're in John 1, as we've spent quite a bit of time on, we have that witness to Christ, especially in the words of others, the prologue, the gospel, or the witness of John and the witness of some of those disciples. Then when you get to the end of chapter 5, you're going to have another testimony to Christ. He's going to refer to the works, his works, the Father, Moses, the Scriptures, John the Baptist, other people and things. And he's going to witness again. Now it's going to be especially in his words. So this whole section, this whole five chapters here really kind of are enveloped in the witness and the testimony of the Lord Jesus Christ. And you kind of see that as you go in. And that's the thing about this kind of structure. You're heading down, and this middle point is really the important point. It's kind of the hinge which the doors work. And so when you go to John 2 and John 4 and the first part of John 5, you're going to see two encounters that involve responses. One of the responses will be in unambiguous faith. It's going to be declared. They believed. And we see that, of course, in Mary and the disciples here. And then you're going to have the temple cleansing. And there it's going to be left ambiguous. You get the idea they didn't believe, but it's not stated explicitly. Well, you're going to get the same thing at the end of chapter 4 and on into chapter 5. You're going to have two encounters. One is going to be declared to be explicitly have resulted in faith. And now you've gone from just faith to faith without sight. Without seeing, he believes. And then you'll have another one that's left ambiguous again. And that ambiguity, we don't really like that. We like to know definitively, do they believe, do they not believe? And we, commentators, spend a lot of time, was that enough faith for them to get saved, or was it not enough? Was it saving faith? Was it not? That's really not the point he's bringing out here. This ambiguity, remember, this is at a very early stage of his ministry. And he's leaving the door open. He's not closing the door on anyone at this point. They may not understand and respond perfectly at first, but maybe, just maybe, with a little time, they'll percolate in their thinking, be exposed to it a little more, the door's still open, and it might not, in fact, be unbelief. It might be belief. Then you see, as you go to the nether, two main encounters that actually have a lot of dialogue and monologue, and you get the encounter with Nicodemus. Again, here you have that ambiguous faith. You don't really know from the context. Here, you're inclined to think he believed, but you're not told it specifically. But of course, when it comes to the Samaritan woman, you're told specifically, especially the whole Samaritan village believed. The whole village came out. And right in the hinge here, you have this section at the end of chapter 3 that hinges this all together, that transitions from John the Baptist's ministry, We look at that passage last week, but John the Baptist's ministry, and it talks about him going someplace where there was much water. And then that transitions to Jesus, who's in the wilderness where there's not that much water, because now Jesus is going to be the source of self-created water. And especially, it's going to go on in the very next section with the Samaritan woman, living waters. And you have a whole different level of ministry that John the Baptist wasn't involved in and couldn't have done. So you have this transition. I think it's good just to kind of keep this broader, general overlook, to kind of keep the whole passage in mind. And we're going to see this ambiguous faith or ambiguous unbelief or ambiguous belief. It's kind of like, remember, I think it was in Mark, you had the man and he said, and Jesus asked him, "Do you believe?" And he said, "Yes, I believe." And then what does he say? He says, "Help me in my unbelief." And that's kind of that ambiguous kind of faith. And that's what we're going to see, especially as we go through these first five chapters. You get beyond that, and then Jesus starts stating explicitly, or the narrator, John, the writer, John, states explicitly they didn't believe. Then the doors start closing. But at this early part, remember, these first four or five chapters here of John fit into the very beginning of Matthew. It was, you fit them in between right after the temptation of Satan in the wilderness and right before Jesus goes to Galilee in the Matthew account. So this is very early. And even when the response doesn't seem to be in faith, the door is still left open. They're not declared in unbelief yet. So that's what we're going to see here as we go along. We looked at Jesus' encounter with his mother Mary, and we saw that pattern. And this is going to be the pattern for every single one of the encounters that we're going to come across as we get through over to chapter 5, and really on into the rest of the chapters as well. We're going to have something the character, in this case it's Mary, something the character says or is concerned about. In this case, comes up to Jesus and she says, "They've run out of wine." And she's going to be, that's going to be her external vocalized concern. But of course, we looked last week of all the characters in John or any of the other gospel accounts, of all the characters, we know more about what's in Mary's heart, soul, spirit, mind than any other character. So Jesus is going to respond in a way that doesn't, he's going to kind of just brush aside her comment, and he's going to then talk to her and show her something that is going to reach into her deepest concern. And we looked at that last week. Instead of focusing, Jesus' response is, "Woman," you know, kind of a little bit surprising. "What have I to do with thee? Mysteriously, my hour has not come." Instead of focusing on Mary's relatively unimportant external concern, wine running out at a wedding festival, as important as I'm sure it was to them in the scope of God and the universe, not a real important thing. Jesus plunges to the depth of her heart, to her deepest and dearest concerns. And of course, we know of all the characters. We're going to see why I think this is the first sign, and we'll talk about that in a minute, because we actually know what's in Mary's heart. And we know, we looked at that last week, we know she's all those promises that God made to her about who her son was, what he was going to do. He's going to be the salvation of Israel, the king of Israel. He's going to save Israel from her predicament, redeem Israel, deliver Israel, save Israel from her enemies, usher Israel into that, and restore Israel into that kingdom. And that's what's in the, and she says she treasured that, she cherished it in her heart and in her soul, as she thought about it constantly. And he's going to now go to the depths of that. It looks like he's not going to do what she wants, because it kind of gets sidetracked by what he says. But instead, he's going to go to the deepest, darkest recesses, the most important concern. And he's going to change the water to wine. He's going to give her a display. And we'll look at some of the typology within this passage another time. But he's going to go to the promises that God made to her about what the son would do, and he's going to show her, give her a foretaste, I guess would be the best thing, way to describe it, of those kingdom blessings that her son was going to usher in. And in changing the water to the wine, the restoration of the nation of Israel, and all that that plays into that, he shows to her. And of course, on the way, he restores the source of wine at this ordinary Jewish wedding as well. And so we looked at that last week, and that's what we're going to see, a pattern. We're going to look at these, and first you're going to have the character say something, kind of an external concern that's not real important. You see that with the Samaritan woman. She comes, she wants to talk about this well water, with literal natural water in a well, and he kind of brushes that all aside, and he talks about living water ushering up within her. And she's taken off balance by that. Nicodemus is going to come to her saying all kinds of good things about Jesus. And Jesus just sweeps that away, and you got to be born again. And he kind of throws him off balance, because Jesus is going to take the things, the ordinary, everyday things they're saying, and he's going to take it now to their deepest needs, their deepest concerns, their deepest desires and longings that even they may very well not know they have. But Jesus knows they're there. His intimacy with humanity in becoming a man. All right, so we want to go to the end of this passage, and we're going to focus on verse 11 at the end of this passage, John 1, verse 11. This beginning of miracles, if you have a King James, it's miracles. We're going to have to talk about that in a second. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed him. So here we have, it says, this is the first sign. Now, remember what the purpose of John is. Keep your finger here, but go to the end of John. John 20, look at verse 30. John 20, verse 30. It says here, and many other signs, this is John 20, verse 30, truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these, and these are, refers to the signs, the signs John wrote and recorded in the Gospel of John, so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the King of Israel, the Son of David, who's also the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. We're back to that I am Jehovah name. Everything is going to happen by throwing themselves on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. That'll kick into their redemption, their deliverance, or avengement. That's going to usher them in the kingdom, be their blesser, their king, plant them in the land, restore them as a nation, and raise them above all other nations on the earth. And it's all going to happen because he does it for them. He's going to have to do it for them. My point here at this point is that the whole point John wrote the Gospel of John's was to present some signs whereby they would believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and the I am Jehovah God of Israel. And so these signs are important. So we have to take note of them pretty closely. So the first thing I want to look at, going back to John 1, in the verse 11, it says this beginning. That word for beginning is sometimes translated first in the first kind of a concept, and it's usually taken in that sense, and it's kind of the idea of first in a series, or the first of a number, and that it makes sense to take it in that way, because where it says here this is the first of something, go to John 4. This is in Cana. When he goes back to Cana, he does the miracle with the nobleman's son, the sign with the nobleman's son. And look what he says in verse 54. This is, again, the second miracle or sign in Cana. And so There you have the idea that it could be, it's probably most likely used in the way we would use the word first. It's the first miracle. But this idea of beginning or first can be used in a little different sense too. It can be used in the sense of primary, some kind of a foundational way of using it. And that would make a lot of sense too, because as I've been suggesting in this example of the encounter with Mary, this is kind of, especially if you put it together with the encounter with Nathaniel and the put together the encounter of Mary, those two kind of come together to be a primary, a kind of example or pattern of how all the other encounters are going to occur. This one encounter with Mary, because she's the only character we're really going to know her heart in great detail anyhow. So it could also be used in the sense of the primary. And I don't know that you have to rule out in either of those definitions. Maybe there's a little bit of overlap there. And just like, remember in the parables, there you had the parable of the sower, and it was kind of used as in the first in the sense of primary. It was a pattern parable that once you figured how that one worked, you could kind of figure out to some degree anyhow how the rest of the parables work. Well, I'd suggest that perhaps this beginning, first, primary, in reference to this encounter with Mary and the sign of the changing of the water into wine, not only means it's the first numerically, but also from a primary. It's a patterning encounter that kind of shows us how it's kind of a key that opens up how to the door to understanding at least more and better some the other encounters he has. So that's where two ways you can take that word, and we'll take a look at more details as we go through that. So we do have to take a minute here, though, and look at verse 11. This is the beginning of miracles. Unfortunately, the King James here doesn't translate the word John uses consistently. There's two words for miracles and signs. One is used by the synoptics, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Theirs is almost, and not exclusively, but almost invariably, when they're talking about miracles, they use this Greek word dunamis, which means supernatural power, some kind of display of supernatural power. John doesn't ever use this word, dunamis. He doesn't use that word. He uses the word Simeon. You know, we get that. It's carried over into our English language with semaphore, signals, pointers to something, signs. He only uses the word Simeon, which is translated usually as signs. So, since signs are so important in John, what we're going to have to do is really go with the New King James. The New King James does translate John's word consistently, always as the word sign. So if you have a King James, you need to remember in the book of John, if you read the word miracle or miracles, it's really the word signs. So just keep that in mind. And I only make a big point of that because John makes the point that the purpose of the book is to list out these signs. So John only uses the word Simeon, sign. He's using it, this is a little different, not so much as supernatural displays of power as much as signals and sign and pointers to some things that we'll see with each encounter. So we're going to follow the New King James on this. They translate all John's words, the Simeon words, the same with the word signs. Signs, and the important thing, why that's important, is that signs are not always miracles. You can have, by miracle, when we use dunamis, which is the way it's typically used, signs are not always miracles. They're not always the result of miraculous, supernatural displays of power. There's another kind of sign, and that's called a prophetic sign. And you see that quite a bit in the prophets. whereby it doesn't involve supernatural power. Here we're going to look at a little bit later, Ezekiel and Isaiah. They're just going to go out. Ezekiel's going to go out, lay on the ground and pantomime the destruction of Jerusalem. He's going to put on a little play, and he's going to, and that's called a prophetic sign. So I guess I just want to make sure we go away with here. And John, whenever you see the word miracles in your King James, that's always the word signs, and should be translated as signs. And while you can argue that all miracles are signs, all miracles may point to something, all signs are not miracles. And so we just want to keep that differentiation in mind. We're going to stick with the New King James on this and consistently translate all of John's words, Simeon, with the word signs, not the word miracles. So if I'm reading something out and I'm reading along and I use the word miracles, you'll know already that what I should be saying is signs. All right, because I read out of the King James here. So what is a sign? Simply put, signs point beyond themselves. Again, they're like our semaphore where, you know, you put signs or up on a mountaintop and they flash from mountaintop to mountaintop of signals and that kind of thing. They point beyond themselves to deeper realities that could be perceived with the eyes of faith. Specifically, in John, it's going to be pointing to the glory of God in Christ, in Jesus Christ, so we can see that he's his true representative, that he's truly God incarnate. So that brings us to the good question, what are the signs in John? And you'll see why knowing the translating the word signs is important, consistently is important, and you'll see why in a minute. So I found this set of criterion, rather than just make up or just kind of guess at what they are, I saw one commentator gave a set of criterion. I thought that was at least a good way to start. We don't have to keep to this criteria, but maybe that's a good way to get the ball rolling in determining what are the signs that John thought was so important they'd convince anyone reading this gospel that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, the I Am Jehovah God of Israel. So I thought we would just start with these three criteria. I didn't come up with them, but I thought they at least give us an entry into this. And then we can look at potentially other signs that may not fit these criteria. So the first criteria that this commentator had is that a given work is performed by Jesus as part of his public ministry. So that's criterion one. Criteria two is that it explicitly identified as a sign in John's gospel. That's going to be the best indicator, right? If it's explicitly said this is a sign, well, then we know it's a sign. And in most of the cases that are listed, usually in the context, there's that reference. Sometimes it's a little far in context, and we'll look at that with one of those examples. But usually there's a reference to it being a sign in the context of the book. And then the third criterion is the event with its accompanying symbolism points to God's glory displayed in Christ, Jesus, thus revealing Jesus as God's true representative. So if we at least use these three criterion as a starting point, these are the signs in John. There would be six of them. And so we've already read the water to wine. That's in chapters 2, verse 11. Let's just see how this all fits. First of all, obviously, it's performed by Jesus in his earthly public ministry here. Obviously, it meets criterion one. It obviously meets criterion number three. Changing water into wine demonstrates the glory of God and in Christ. We just read where we are tonight. It meets criteria two because it is referred in verse 11. This is the beginning or the primary of signs. That Jesus in Cana of Galilee. All right, so that's the first one. Then the next one that would meet all those criteria, and we'll kind of just look at these. We're not going to read these whole passages, but let's go to John 4. And now we're back in Cana again. Remember in chapter 2, we were in Cana of Galilee. He's going to go back to Jerusalem. He's going to go to Judea. He's going to go to Samaria. And then he's then going to end up back in Galilee again. And here we are back in Galilee, in Cana of Galilee. And here we have the healing of the nobleman's son. So Jesus, verse 46, John 4, 46. So Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine. So here we have a clear indicator. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum, and the nobleman asked him to heal his son. His son is near death. He's asked Jesus to heal him. And so, of course, Jesus does heal him. And so, of course, it meets criterion one. This is all something that Christ does in his public ministry here. And then it obviously meets criterion three. It displays the glory of God, was brought him back from the clutches of death into life. And look at verse 54. He says, this is again the second miracle that Jesus did when he would come out of Judea into Galilee. So here we have the second. See, I said it again. I was reading my King James. Second sign that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea of Galilee. So here we have, it meets all three criterion. The healing of the nobleman's son. It's something that Christ does in his public ministry. It's something that displays the glory of God, and it's something that context itself indicates was a sign. Next, we have the healing of the lame man, and he's going to go up to a lame man. He's going to heal the lame man, and the lame man's going to jump up and move, and so he does heal him. And Jesus is going to that obviously meets criterion one and three. It happened in his public ministry. It displays the glory of God. This is the only one that's a little bit iffy because while it meets the first and third criterion, it doesn't say it's a sign until quite a bit later. You actually get over to chapter 7. So the miracle happens in chapter 5, but then there's he's going to give a little bit. He's going to give this testimony we talked about in our structure. He's going to feed the multitude, walk on the water, and talk about the bread of life. And then if you go over to chapter 7, you pick it up at verse 21. Chapter 7, verse 21. Jesus answered and said unto them, I have done one work, and you have marveled. Moses, therefore, gave unto you circumcision, not that it is of Moses, and ye on the Sabbath day. That is not the passage I wanted. I'll have to come back to that. But Jesus does mention it again. Oh, here we go. I guess I should just keep reading. Verse 23. If a man on the Sabbath day receives circumcision. Now, one thing I forgot to mention in chapter 5 is he healed the lame man on the Sabbath day. So that became the whole issue and what sets the groundwork for everything that's happened in the two chapters after chapter 5. And he says, if you can circumcise a man on the Sabbath day, according to the law of Moses, should not be broken. Are you angry at me because I have made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day? That's the lame man. Then the miracle happened in chapter 5. We're in chapter 7, but that's what he's referring back to. And judge not according to the appearance, but judge according to righteous judgment. Look at verse 31. And many of the people believed on him and said, when Christ comes, will he do more signs than these which this man hath done? And so you could take that in the context here, even though it picked up quite a bit after. Now he's referring back to that lame man, and the people listening to him identify it as a sign. So while that might be a little bit further from the context, we're going to give him that one too. It happened in in his public ministry. It demonstrated the glory of God, and a little bit later, it appears to be identified as a sign. Then you had the feeding of the multitude, verse chapter 6. This is another one. Of course, it happens in his earthly ministry. He, out of just five barley loaves and two small fish, he fed the multitudes, 5,000 men, it said. So unless it was an all-male crowd, you probably could be safely assumed there's 5,000 women. And if they were all married, they all had one or two kids, you're back to 15, 20,000 people he's fed with that little bit. Demonstrates the glory of God. And if we look at verse 26, chapter 6, verse 26. Jesus answered and said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me, not because you saw the signs, but because you did eat the loaves and were filled." So there the context does seem to indicate the feeding of the multitude was a sign, identified as a sign in the context. Then the next one, we have the healing of the man born blind. And of course, that's another one where it happened in Christ's earthly ministry. It displays the glory of God. Criterion 1 and 3 are met. And let's see if it's identified as a sign. Go to chapter 9. Verse 16. Chapter 9, verse 16. "Therefore said some of the Pharisees," now this is right after the man born blind is in the first part of chapter 9. Now we're in verse 16. "Therefore said some of the Pharisees, this man is not of God, but because he keepeth not the Sabbath day. Others said, how can a man that is a sinner do such signs?" So in the context, at least the people there present with him identified it as a sign. So that it would meet those three criterion. The last one that would meet all those criterion is the raising of Lazarus. Of course, it happens in his public ministry. Of course, it displays the glory of God. Go to chapter 11 now, verse 47. And the Pharisees are plotting to kill him at this point. The raising of Lazarus kind of sets this all in motion. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, what do we? For this man doeth many signs. And again, it's in the context of the raising of Lazarus. So if we just go strictly by those three criteria, there's six signs in the Gospel of John listed out here. So let's go beyond those criteria, though. Let's see if there's additional signs. What do some other people suggest might be signs in the Gospel of John? If we go back to chapter 2 now, and this is why it's important to realize the importance of translating Simeon as consistently with the word signs, because you might miss something. If you're just thinking a miracle, a powerful display of supernatural power, you might miss other kinds of signs. If you just call all signs miracles, you might miss another kind of sign, and we mentioned it earlier, those prophetic signs. And some suggest in chapter 2 that you have here a prophetic sign, and that's in the cleansing of the temple. While it's not miraculous, let's just read a couple of verses of it here. In verse 14, this is right after the marriage, the water to wine in Cana, and he goes on now, and he goes to Jerusalem, verse 14, "and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them out." And we usually just call it the cleansing of the temple. And certainly this does meet, again, criterion 1 and 3. It meets criterion 1. It's something he's doing in his public ministry. It meets criterion 3 because look what the leaders, the Jewish leaders of the temple, say to him. Look at verse 18. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, What sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? So they saw an authority involved in that. They saw that there was an authority that could only come from God, although they didn't recognize it as that. But they saw something did display, and so we could say that met criterion three, put on display the glory of God. He was cleansing his father's house. And the other thing we could notice from here is that there's a similar situation. Go over to where we were before with the feeding of the multitude. Go to chapter 6. Now, he's just fed the multitude, the 5,000. We already determined that's identified as a sign. So he already did that sign. But look what the leaders say. Look at chapter 6, verse 30. They said therefore unto him, What sign showest thou then, that we may see and believe thee? What dost thou work? And so here you had, he just did a sign, the feeding of the 5,000, and yet the Jewish leaders come up and say, Show us a sign. Well, you have the same type of situation back in chapter 2. If the cleansing of the temple is a sign, and then the Jewish leaders come out and say, Show us a sign. You see the same type of pattern, which might indicate if it's similar to what's in chapter 6. In the context of a sign, which in chapter 6 was the feeding of the 5,000, here it's the cleansing of the temple, and the Jewish leaders' response in both cases is, Show us a sign. And so you might have a little hint if that's a pattern. If this is a sign, this would be a sign in the prophetic sense, not in the miraculous sense, not in the miraculous display of supernatural power. He's doing it through his own power, I guess you could say. He's making accords and he's flinging it around, kicking people out of the temple. And so this would be a sign in a prophetic sense. And you see this over and over again in the Old Testament. Let's just look at a couple examples and just to kind of reiterate, because this one seems to be not as familiar as the miraculous signs. And if you don't translate, again, that Simeon consistently, you could miss signs that aren't necessarily miracles. They could be this prophetic kind of sign. So go to Isaiah. Isaiah 20, and I'm not going to these to develop all the background context here, but Isaiah is going to do something here. And look what he says, and we'll just start at verse 2. We're interested not so much in what's actually going on here as what Isaiah is doing. At the same time, this is Isaiah 20, verse 2, at the same time spoke the Lord by Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saying, Go and loose the sackcloth from off thine loins, and put off thy shoe from thy foot, and he did, walking naked and barefoot. And the Lord said, Like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a what? A sign and a wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia. And that's a judgment called upon Egypt and all that. And that's not the point. If the point is that was a sign, but it wasn't a miraculous supernatural display of power. It was a sign in sense of a prophetic sign. Isaiah walked around the land in his underwear for a long time and did that. Ezekiel does something similar. Go to Ezekiel chapter 4. Chapter 4, Ezekiel 4. Here we have the destruction of Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem. And again, we're not going to develop the whole background here. We're just trying to bring out what Ezekiel is going to do. And look what the Lord tells Ezekiel to do. Ezekiel 4, verse 1. Thou also, son of man, take thee a tile and lay it before thee and portray upon it the city, even Jerusalem. So he's supposed to take a tile and paint, draw a picture of Jerusalem on it. And then a lace, and then he sets it up in the ground next to him. He's laying on the ground, and he sets up the tile, and then he lays siege to it. Boom, boom, boom. I don't know what he does. Throw rocks at it. He's going to list out some things here. Cast a mound against it. Throw a mountain against it. Set a camp against it. Set battering rams against it. All around about. Make over. Take thou unto thee an iron pan and set it before a wall of iron between thee and the city, and set thy face against it, and it shall be besieged, and thou shalt lay siege to it. This shall be a what? A sign to the house of Israel. And there, of course, it wasn't a sign in the sense of a miracle. It wasn't a miraculous display of supernatural power. He was pantomiming the destruction and judgment of Jerusalem that was coming upon them from Babylon. So we go back to John 2. That could be some people. This is why some people consider the cleansing of the temple to be a sign, not so much a miraculous display of power sign, supernatural power, but a prophetic sign. Some of the other things that people do assign a sign, some people identify Jesus' death and resurrection as a sign. And maybe you could even get that a little bit out of this passage, because they're going to ask him back in John 2, verse 18. They ask him for a sign, and his response, verse 19, Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. And then look what he's really talking about there, verse 21, but he spake of the temple, his body, his death, kind of a foretelling of his coming death and resurrection. He responds to their request for a sign by saying that. But if we go outside John, look at Matthew 12, verse 38. So you have here the scribes. Now you got to remember, up to this time, Jesus has done all kinds of miracles and signs. But look at what the Jewish leaders do. Verse 38. Then certain of the scribes and of the Pharisees answered, saying, Master, we would see a sign. Well, what's he been doing for 12 chapters? He's been doing signs and miracles. But he answered and said unto them, an even adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given it but the sign of the prophet Jonah. And what's the sign? That sign? For as Jonah was in the was 3 days and 3 nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and nights in the heart of the earth. So there you have it. Matthew explicitly calls the death and resurrection of Christ a sign. So some people consider that to be a sign. So it passes Numbers 2 and 3, but probably doesn't pass number 1. Does it really qualify for something Jesus does in his public ministry? I guess that would be something that could be argued over. Others think, want to include the walking on the water. But again, it doesn't meet all the criterion. While it meets criterion number 2 and 3, it's never identified. It meets criterion 1 and 3, and it doesn't meet number 2. It's never identified as a sign in the actual text. It's never referred to as a sign. So some people, though, do include that. Final one is some include at the end of the book, after his resurrection, the surplus of fishes. Remember, they throw the net over the side, and it's so full of fishes, it breaks the net. And so some people include that, the surplus of fishes. But again, this is not explicitly defined or identified as a sign by John in the actual text. Nor is it really part of his public ministry, if that ended before the cross. So again, that might be arguable, but it is never identified as a sign in the text. So with all this in mind, here are the generally agreed upon, six generally agreed on by everybody signs in the book of John. The water to wine, the healing the nobleman's son, the lame man, feeding the multitude, healing the man born blind, raising of Lazarus, and then possible additions to that would be the cleansing of the temple, the walking on the water, and the surplus of fishes, and possibly, I don't have it here, but the death and resurrection, the resurrection especially, death and resurrection of Christ as a sign. All right, so just to kind of wrap this up for next time with that identification as the signs. The other thing I want to introduce, and this will be the third part of things we'll look at with each of these signs. Remember the three parts. So the first part is you have some, he interacts or encounters someone who just says something or does something or asks for something or is concerned about something. Like Mary, they've run out of wine, like the Samaritan woman with her Jacob's well, like the whole bunch of other people that we're going to encounter. Jesus is going to take what they say and respond in a way that goes far deeper, plunges far deeper, not so much into the concern they're vocalizing at that moment, but that leads to a bigger concern inside. He takes it from an external, superficial kind of concern to an internal, in-depth concern that that's going to lead to the fulfillment and the satisfaction and the meeting of their deepest, dearest concerns and desires and thoughts and questions and longings. And then we're going to look, each of these will have then a series of typology. People see very little typology. Other people, you know, almost every word is somehow a type. We're going to go kind of the middle ground there, and we'll just kind of look at some of the things. That's what we'll do next time we're in John 2. We'll look at some of the typology in the encounter with Mary and the turning the water into wine. But just to kind of give a taste for it, the signs may be representative of the problems and solutions for the nation of Israel. And if we just look at some of these signs that we listed out in the previous slides, you had the water to wine, and that kind of matches up with, if you include the surplus of fishes, those two kind of go together because they demonstrate the abundance of the kingdom, the abundance of what Christ is going to usher in as the king and blesser in that kingdom. And it also demonstrates the ruin of the nation of Israel, how they're deprived of these things now. Nathanael's under his withered tree and praying for the deliverance of Israel. Mary's out looking for the vine, the fig tree and the vine, the metaphor for the kingdom. Everyone sits under their fig tree. Everyone enjoys their vine. Those are types of the nation of Israel. Mary's out. She's looking for the fruit of the vine. She can't find any. And so we go beyond just what's happening at that wedding ceremony. And there's a whole pointer. That's why it's a sign. It points to something far greater. It's kind of like what Jesus does when he takes what they say and goes far deeper. The sign points to something, especially for the nation of Israel, especially for the believing remnant of Israel, and what they're going to enjoy in the future. When they're delivered, or what they're going to need to do as they go through that time of trouble and what we call that tribulation period. So with some other ones here we could pair up. The healing of the nobleman's son and Lazarus. Those are both the little boy, the son, and Lazarus. Of course, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. The son was in the grips of death and may have been dead at that time or right in the very grips of death. They're both raised up from the clutches of death. And that's that points to, that sign concept, it points to the situation of the nation of Israel. They need to be revived and resurrected from the dead. And there's whole passages in the Old Testament that talk about the resurrection of the nation of Israel. Not so much the individual Israelites, the way we normally think of personal resurrection, which of course that's true as well, but also the resurrection of the nation, the restoration of the nation, the calling out of the nation from that believing remnant, especially at the end of that tribulation period. They're being held in the graves of the Gentiles, and they're going to be called out, regathered, planted in the land of Israel, restored and raised above all other nations. So you have here in the picture of the healing of the nobleman's son and the raising of Lazarus, you have this picture, this pointer, this sign that points to the restoration and resurrection of the nation Israel. Healing of the lame man, healing of the blind man, they kind of go together, both showing healing that was impossible for men to do on their own. This is, and in those passages, it starts introducing the high point of Christ using his I Am Jehovah name. If they are going to be the people God created and designed them to be, he would have to do everything for them. The only thing they were supposed to do is, out of faith, fall on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. He'd put him back up on the eagle, just like he did way back at the Exodus, only at the end of the tribulation is going to be a far greater Exodus, infinitely greater Exodus. He's going to put him back on the eagle, and he's going to fly him into the land and into the kingdom. He has to do everything for him. Here you have an example of two people that couldn't do anything for themselves. And he heals them. Israel's only answer is to fall on the grace resident and the Lord Jesus Christ and his Jehovah name. Two more we'll just mention. I'm just doing this to kind of whet our appetites, kind of get us thinking along these lines. And we'll actually look in more detail at a bunch of things in each of these encounters that point to some of these things. But these are just some general ones that kind of come out to the surface. It says in the next two, feeds the multitude, calms the sea. Both show Christ as the creator, the all-powerful one. Israel needs to be, points to, it's a sign. That Israel needs to be created anew, delivered from her enemies. And this is going to be something that especially that believing remnant of Israel is going to have to fall on. They're going to have to rely on the Lord Jesus Christ to preserve in that tribulation period, especially the last half of that tribulation period, rely on him to preserve them and protect them and deliver them and avenge them of their enemies in that time of tribulation that they go through. So those are some of the things where the sign concept, typology, signs, what those signs are meant to point towards, what they're supposed to be meant to point to. And Jesus takes what those encounters with the characters is and takes it to the depths of their soul and their greatest needs and their greatest concerns. The signs point to the greatest and neatest the needs of the nation of Israel and that believing remnant if they're to be preserved through the time that is coming.